Gallatin Valley and online listeners, this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM Radio 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm your host, Roxana, and maybe in rebellion against all the hoopla about the last 250 years, I've been reflecting on things much, much older. Right now, let's open with Ken Lane's creation, released on June 24th, 2022. Here is Area 51's mysterious petroglyph, Paranagat Man.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and it is officially summertime now. No comment. The consolation of these coming months is that each day has a little more darkness. We got some thunder, we got some rain this week. Monsoon season visited the Mojave, it brought dust storms to the endless miles of Phoenix. Left us hot and dry again. I've been putting out more water for the doves and the bunnies, but then I saw something thrashing around in the bird bath. And there's this little fence lizard, about 3 inches long, is half drowned. I fish it out, I leave it in the shade, and very slowly the lizard dries out and gets it together and walks on down the patio. And then the doves are back, the birds with the sweetest souls, the morning doves. A lot of people find it sad, the call of the morning dove. But it's a beautiful song, and it makes you think about it all. And then here comes a big roadrunner making its rounds, and the cactus wrens are noisy and active this time of year. And then I hear another call. It's shrill and weird, and followed by the screech of red-tailed hawks who live up high in the Big Pinyon. And there's a fledgling atop the smaller pine. Second fledgling I've seen from this pair, and is making that terrified sound. My God, don't leave me out here like this. Let me back in the nest. Bring me some chewed up rat, for God's sake. The coveys of quail are chattering and pecking the ground. Latest generation of Mojave cottontails hop around at night. I saw a whole batch of coyote pups, too, singing together and then disappearing into the junipers and the rocks when they got wind of somebody walking nearby. Springtime in the high desert lasts a little bit longer. The nights are comfortable, the days are bearable if you stay in the shade. The days are best when you sleep through them. Nothing going on anyway. Nothing good. Ha ha ha! is a smooth playa of hardened sand and minerals. When it rains, which it does every now and then, the former lake is briefly blessed with a sheen of shallow water that reflects the desert sky. When this occurs, the birds appear on these usually dry lake beds. Immense flocks of migrating ducks and geese and more exotic species that spot the temporary oasis from high above and settle in while the water lasts, which is not for long. Besides, this is a place of human disturbance. The playa here is for the testing of exotic aircraft at unpredictable hours. In the autumn of 1849, a wagon train of Gold Rush pioneers led by Captain Jefferson Hunt camped at the dry lake. Hunt was Kentucky-born and had joined the Latter-day Saints cause at Nauvoo, Illinois. A high priest and a proud polygamist, he had fled Illinois in the wake of Joseph Smith's murder at the hands of an anti-Mormon mob. And he earned his rank in the Mormon battalion before hiring himself out as a trail guide to the 49ers arriving daily in Salt Lake City. Itself still a rough camp that had been settled by the Mormons only 2 years earlier. The Donner Party had passed through in 1846. It scattered and weary families attempting an October crossing of the Sierra Nevada. Of the 87 souls together at Utah's Wasatch Mountains, only 48 made it over the Sierra. Gruesome tales of their misfortune sold many newspapers the following spring and discouraged the meek. A southern route that avoided the Sierra was the only choice once snow began falling. The dilemma at Groom Lake was that no one was familiar with the southern trail to the California goldfields, and only the Mormons had any experience with the desert in this party. Here the wagon train split up and wearying misadventures were suffered. The parties would mostly meet up again at the place they would name Death Valley. The name was an exaggeration. Only one of the Death Valley 49ers perished there, and the Tambosha Shoshone have lived in the valley and surrounding forested mountains for 1,000 years. It is relatively easy to travel across the Great Basin and Mojave Desert today. People still die on the road or die on day hikes a few miles from busy campgrounds, but it takes no special skill to survive the journey, especially as a tourist. Water is secured from faucets and convenience stores. It is unnecessary, unlike in Captain Hunt's time, to read the landscape to correctly guess that Crystal Springs in the Paranagat Valley would have at least a little water, enough for the people and their starving oxen. Crystal Springs is now served by an automobile rest stop on Nevada's Highway 375, a place where the pioneers would have seen strange figures upon the boulders. Haunting petroglyphs of weird entities looming over bighorn sheep and coyotes and humans. If these confused 49ers went up Mount Irish in search of water and forage for their beast of burden, more of these eerie figures would have been visible. Packed into the boulders hundreds and even thousands of years before the gold rush. This distinctive rock art, accessed today by that modern highway, is found only within Lincoln County, Nevada. There are two main types of mystery figures here. A decorated rectangle known to anthropologists as the Piranagat Pattern Body Anthropomorph, or PBA. And the humanoid entity simply called Piranagat Man. One prominent example of the latter makes it clear that this figure is male. What P-Man represents to you will depend largely upon your age and the culture you grew up within. Those who spent a lot of time watching television at the turn of the century might see Bender, the alcoholic robot from the animated series Futurama. The devout may see the devil of their nightmares. With its long bony fingers and hollow, expressionless eyes. Unlike many ghostly floating figures of ancient rock art, Piranagat Man usually has humanoid limbs, legs, feet, jointed arms, hands with fingers and thumbs. And if you are familiar with the folklore of extraterrestrial alien pilots visiting the Earth in spaceships, these figures on the desert rocks look like space monsters. Aliens. No one is sure how old they are or who made them. It's notoriously difficult to carbon date ancient rock art, as petroglyphs in particular don't rely upon organic paint or pigment. And radiocarbon dating is less helpful without the presence of carbon. But educated guesses can be made based on the relative age of nearby artifacts such as rubbish piles and ancient campsites. And at least some of the Piranagat Valley figures and patterns are pictographs, made with charcoal or blood or plants or whatever else was available for dyes and paints. Petroglyphs, which get their color from exposing the rock surface beneath the natural desert varnish it often covers weather-exposed boulders, tend to outlive their painted companions. This is why various experts will claim the Piranagat rock art dates back more than 3,500 years, or 5,000 years, or maybe only 500 years. Crude stick figures of Spanish horsemen argue for later dates, but the large and elaborate figures of the entities share nothing but a canvas with those post-colonial scribbles. What is known is that people have lived in the Piranagat Valley for at least 12,000 years. Those first inhabitants were the Patillon and Anasazi. And most archaeologists believe that these early Pueblo peoples created the astonishing rock art figures of southern Nevada. Modern Shoshone, Paiute, Mojave, Ute, even Comanche, who split from the Shoshone and made the mostly dry White River their western territorial boundary, have occupied the territory since the arrival of the Spanish. Figures of sprightly bighorn sheep and human families of parents and children require little interpretation. But the immense gap in time, culture, language, and mythology makes it impossible for either archaeologists or today's native peoples to accurately read the abstract and symbolic rock art, which was left by prehistoric tribes. What should we make of the striking images left behind by ancient nomads in the Mount Irish wilderness? Such as the insect-like humanoid standing next to what looks to modernize like a giant sombrero or a 1950s flying saucer. What do we make of the human figure cowering behind his shield? In the paranoid peacetime gap between World War II and the Cold War, the UFO era was born. And it began in the western United States over the course of a few early summer days in 1947, with the pilot Kenneth Arnold's sighting of a fleet of boomerang-shaped silvery craft over Mount Rainier, followed by hundreds of sightings by other credible witnesses. By July 8 of that year, only 2 weeks after Arnold's sighting, Roswell Army Air Field in New Mexico announced that the, quote, many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality, end quote. Supposedly, a crash disc was retrieved from a local rancher's rangeland. The U.S. military would spend half of the next century walking back that press release. Groom Lake began its military life as a World War II aircraft gunnery range, and the isolation of the dry lake made it the choice of California's aerospace industry for the testing of incredible new surveillance aircraft for the escalating Cold War. Lockheed was working on a fantastic high-altitude spy plane. The secrecy around the project meant that Edwards Air Force Base in the western Mojave was too visible, too close to Southern California civilization. The Lockheed plant in Palmdale had the same problem, too many people around and above. And so Lockheed's Kelly Johnson took part in an aerial reconnaissance in 1955. With 50 sites under consideration, Johnson took a hunting trip by plane and was shown Groom Lake, surrounded by high, barren mountains and buffered by the immense Nevada test site. "Man alive," said Johnson, the U-2 spy plane's chief designer. "We looked at that lake and we all looked at each other. It was another Edwards. So we wheeled around, landed on that lake, taxied up to one end of it. It was a perfect natural landing field." This extension of Edwards Air Force Base would be kept quiet. Even the name was secret and only barely acknowledged by the CIA in 2013. There are competing theories about where Area 51 came from. Johnson named the site Paradise Ranch. When the CIA referred to the site internally, it was either Groom Lake or Homey Airfield. The high-altitude testing of the U-2 and SR-71 Blackbird caused people in and around Las Vegas to believe they'd seen UFOs, which technically is exactly what they had witnessed. But the alien lore surrounding this airfield was a distinct product of the 1980s. As the Clark County population swelled into fresh desert suburbs, and the new residents began enjoying the clear night skies, there were many rumors about the base beyond Nellis and the Nevada test site. Private pilots were sternly warned away from the area, and employees arrived by a secret airline that flew out of McCarran Airport, right off the Las Vegas Strip. There was already a paranormal late-night talk show on local radio, pre-Art Bell, and there was a wealthy hotel developer in Las Vegas named Robert Bigelow who had a deep personal interest in the UFO mystery. A number of flying saucer conspiracists were already obsessed with the eastern boundary of Area 51, including John Lear, son of the Learjet founder and reportedly a CIA contract pilot. It was John Lear who supposedly introduced a KLAS TV reporter named George Knapp into the flying disc subculture. 1987. And some 2 years later, Robert Lazar appeared on the KLAS TV news to claim he'd worked on reverse-engineered flying saucers. Lazar's voice was electronically altered and his face was in shadow. And he was originally identified only as Dennis. Lear had become a friend of both Lazar and Knapp. Lear vouched for Lazar and claimed they had both witnessed UFOs and test flights over Area 51. Bob Lazar's Area 51 story sounded goofy to real physicists, and his personal life was a mess of running away from bad debt and knocking around the Southwest. From his community college in the Los Angeles suburbs to New Mexico and next to Las Vegas, land of third chances. And then there was the bigamy and moving into his dead wife's house with the new wife, and the felony conviction for running an illegal brothel in Clark County. Now, prostitution is allowed in some Nevada counties, including neighboring Nye, but these backroad bordellos are far from the lucrative tourist trade in Vegas. It did not matter that Lazar had puffed up his resume to include advanced degrees from MIT and Caltech, even though his academic records are limited to some classes at Pierce Community College in the San Fernando Valley. It did not matter much that the one professor Lazar could name from MIT or Caltech turned out to be a teacher at Pierce Community. Bob Lazar delivered the story, and the story hit a nerve. For 30 years after he told his incredible tale on local television that he had worked for a few weeks on recovered flying saucers at an unknown subbase called S4, Lazar mostly lived in obscurity. The new mythology did not need him. It just needed a new Roswell. Area 51 became a meme of the first kind, a deep mythology that burrowed into the collective consciousness and never really left. The X-Files and Independence Day brought the paranoid tales to primetime television and summer blockbusters. Video games, pop music, comic books, and the early internet message boards elaborated the theology. Like Roswell before it, Nevada's Area 51 became a collective dreamland of extraterrestrial secrets. Pilots had been referring to the top-secret Air Force base at Groom Lake as dreamland for years. Strange things were seen over this easternmost extension of Edwards Air Force Base. Wonders in the sky. Some were eventually revealed as the SR-71 and U-2 spy planes. Some were Russian jet fighters stolen from Soviet airfields. And some remain unexplained. Lights dancing in the sky, things that hovered with no visible or audible means of propulsion, sinister black triangles making 180-degree turns and shooting off like meteors. Nevada is mostly federal land, and Area 51 is part of a vast secret complex that includes the nation's nuclear testing grounds at Yucca Flat, Nellis Air Force Base, and the heavily litigated nuclear waste dump within Yucca Mountain. On the northeast side of Area 51, where Highway 375 skirts the base's buffer zone, tourists have been coming for a quarter century to drink alien-labeled bottles of beer at the Little Alien and take some pictures by the rural mailbox that marks a dirt road leading to the edge of the base. There used to be an alien research center down the road in Hico, too, with a giant metallic space alien standing sentry outside the souvenir shop. The Nevada Commission on Tourism quickly recognized the value of the alien legends in the 1990s, and in 1996, the state highway was renamed the Extraterrestrial Highway. actors from the movie Independence Day and the television show Star Trek The Next Generation attended the opening ceremony with then-Governor Bob Miller. A box of science fiction souvenirs went into a time capsule in Rachel, the contents of which will likely baffle archaeologists of the future as the Piranagat Man baffles us today. The rock art can be difficult to find, and that's on purpose. Whether under the administration of a tribe, a military base, a national park, or the Federal Bureau of Land Management, petroglyphs and pictographs usually take a little effort to reach. Any archaeological treasure too close to the paved roads is at risk of casual destruction. Zytex and across the great Mojave Wilderness. This is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from Joshua Tree, and I'm your host, Ken Lane, with soundscapes composed and performed by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. We broadcast on Friday nights at 10 p.m. from our home base in Joshua Tree, KCDZ 107.7 FM, and at various times across the Southwest and beyond on good community stations, including Valley 104.9 FM in King County, that's King County, Washington State. And I identified that station by the wrong frequency on a recent broadcast. I mixed up a number, and I won't say which one, because that would only compound the problem. I guess this happened because they never sent me a bumper sticker. You see, I read the station frequencies off this old file cabinet here in the studio, where I put all the radio station stickers. When Valley 104.9 FM, Incarnation in the Snoqualmie Valley, well, I was just pulling that from faulty memory, I guess. You can find us online at DesertOracle.com. 5 years of radio shows. Subscription to the final issues of our pocket-sized journal. And you can support this show however you like. Some people do it on Patreon.com/DesertOracle, which I sure do appreciate. Or you can pick up our Desert Oracle Volume 1 paperback, 6 months on the Los Angeles Times nonfiction bestsellers list, including this month, June of 2022. It's available at bookstores everywhere. Be careful in that heat out there. We already lost a tourist in Death Valley. Good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgvm.org. I've driven through the Piranagat area, and visiting the Piranagat Man is definitely on my list of destinations. I'm fascinated with the art and culture of humans in the times before colonization. My first exposure to petroglyphs was an area near Thermopolis, Wyoming, years ago. I think it's called Legend Rock. Since then, I've visited a slot canyon near Kanab, Utah, where a long panel depicts a map of some sort, along with animals that were probably there. There's a BLM area in Nevada that is also rich in petroglyphs in several areas. Figures include spiders, people, birds, animals, and insects. And of course, mystery figures that one can only speculate as to the meaning. And by the way, we should respect this art and the power inherent in it. I'm just saying. Well, are you aware of the presence of pictographs in Montana? With respect, you can visit them. One place is near Lewistown, Montana. The family that protects the pictographs of Bear Gulch say this: "This land and the pictograph site have been in our family for three generations. It was purchased from the original homesteaders in the early 1900s. Its history goes far beyond that, though, and we are still learning about it today. Bear Gulch Pictographs is a remarkably well-preserved site full of native paintings, pictographs, and etchings, petroglyphs. It has been lauded as one of the best preserved sites in the country. This site has been extensively documented through tracings, photography, archaeological digs, and carbon dating. Our desire is to share the site for generations to come for enjoyment and education." Well, my husband and I visited there in June 2025 for the grand opening of the visitor center. I recorded some of the tour narration to share here with you.
Tours of the site, making the fourth generation tour guide. Before me was my uncle, before him was my grandmother, and before her was my great-grandmother. The property has housed five generations of my family. The small house that you saw with the sign that told you to go up to the visitor center, that is actually the original homestead. And in that same spot, there's another building that is actually the original schoolhouse of the Fairview area that both my grandmother, my great uncle, and my great aunt went to school in. The land was originally traded for a team of four horses and I believe a couple of sheep. Imagine if you could get land like that. Like, everybody would have land by now. Our land here is about 250 acres. Fun enough, on our east property, on the Algren Angus Ranch, we also have other Native American historical artifacts. Oh, wow. We have about 30 teepee rings and a medicine wheel.
Wow.
Yes.
Don't you also have some fossils there too?
The fossils are here.
Wow. Well, Macy told me one time she'd seen some outside the house there.
Oh, maybe. So, throughout the years, we've had different people down here. In 2002, we had an archaeological dig in which they found a couple of artifacts, a couple of tools, but no weapons. Now, you will get to see one of the items that they dug up, kind of. You'll get to see the area. However, I can't lift the boards on it because there's a six-foot bull snake that likes to live underneath it. We have over 5,000 individual depictions, making us the largest Northern Plains Indian rock art site in the world. Out of those 5,000 depictions, over 950 of those are shielded warriors, which you'll get to see as soon as we get up on the trail. Other than that, just remember our safety stuff, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask me or to ask David. Ask him a lot of questions. He's in training.
What's the age of the rock art?
So, unfortunately, I don't know the age of the artifacts. However, our carbon dating has led us to believe that these are anywhere from 1,500 years old to 2,000 years old, predating the horse in this area. You will not find a single depiction of a horse down here.
No longer good. So women would stay at the bottom of the hill, wait for the buffaloes to break legs, and then finish them off there. So we have found many bones and skulls.
women got the dirty job. Yeah. And kill the animal.
Tumble across each other, because if one buffalo jumped off, all of the buffalo were going off.
Out towards another depiction of a woman across the crevice. Yeah? Mm. If you have to trust me, or you can come up here and you can see for yourself. Now, with these two women being here stretching their arms out towards each other, this is a depiction of communication. Now, with this crevice being here, a lot of times they would use how the cliff had formed in order to portray different things. With this crevice being here, we believe this to be a depiction of communication from a distance, as many tribes had to split up in order to find resources. Now, we do also have a calendar system down here. As you come along this way, if you look on this face, there's a depiction of a bear on his back. On the summer solstice, there's a shadow that is cast across half the bear, depicting the bear coming out of hibernation and the beginning of those warmer months. Now, on the winter solstice, the sun shines so low in the sky that there is no shadow cast anywhere upon the bear, depicting the bear going back into hibernation and the beginning of those colder months. Now, we may not be home to the largest pictograph in the world. However, we are home to the smallest pictograph in the world. I can show you the second smallest. However, our smallest one can be covered up with the eraser of a number 2 pencil. And right next to him is a 5-inch spear. So our smallest one...
If you'd like to visit this area, please go to beargulch.net. So that's BEARGULCH, all one word, .net, for more information. Plants that have been around much longer than you or me intrigue and inspire me too. I was recently in the Bryce Canyon National Park and revisited some very old friends there, the bristlecone pines. The oldest of those trees is said to be 1,600 years old, though that's young for the species. The oldest living tree is called Methuselah and is 4,765 years old, but she lives in the White Mountains range of eastern California, in a protected area, as I understand it, and I've never met her. Another living thing that might be more ancient than you think is right at your feet. Mosses have been around for 350 million years, classified today as a slowly renewable fossil fuel. Moss puts on an inch of growth in 25 years. Here's an article from the Kelsea newsletter of the Montana Native Plant Society. The article was from Summer 2025, Volume 38, Number 4. And the title of the article by Joe Elliott is What Good Are Mosses? So Joe Elliott writes, recently a friend asked, what good are mosses? My initial reaction was to counter with, what good are giraffes and mountains? But on introspection, I realized that many people, including botanists, often are not aware that bryophytes are ecologically and aesthetically valuable components of the flora. After a bit of thought, I compiled the following discussion of the ecological relationships among mosses, vascular plants, animals, and gardeners. Bryophytes, for example, mosses, liverworts, and hornworts, the earliest land plants, have no vascular tissue and reproduce by spores and asexually from vegetative parts of the plant. Mosses provide the majority of bryophyte biomass, in plant communities and interact ecologically with understory and forest vegetation. Mosses receive all their nutrients and moisture from atmospheric deposition and intercept and retain water. Unlike vascular plants, they do not conduct moisture and nutrients from the substrate to the aerial portions of the plant. Nutrients, water, and other airborne elements are absorbed through the leaves of mosses. Mosses are colonizers of disturbed habitats and provide microhabitats for the germination and growth of early successional vascular plants. Some species of vascular plants only germinate in the presence of mosses. Some rare species of the fern, Botrychium, are closely associated with moss carpets in northwestern Montana. In the coal mining areas of the eastern United States, mosses have been a component in the reestablishment of stable cover of vegetation following mining. Moss carpets in conifer forests accumulate phosphorus and nitrogen from atmospheric dust and precipitation. Studies of black spruce communities have found that mosses account for 75% of the phosphorus accumulation in above-ground vegetation. Mycorrhizal hyphae of fungi are thought to provide a pathway for phosphorus movement from the moss carpet to the roots of the overstory forest. The large forest mosses, common in western Montana, harbor bacteria in their leaf axils that fix atmospheric nitrogen and make it available to associated vegetation when plants die or it is leached by rainwater. Mosses, especially the genus Orthotrichium, which colonize rocks, roofs, and trees, are used as bioindicators of air pollution on the West Coast. Because mosses collect their nutrients from atmospheric sources, they are effective at accumulating airborne pollutants like sulfur, fluoride, and lead, and are excellent tools to assess air quality. Mosses are also a habitat component for wildlife. Although few animals eat mosses, one exception in Montana is the rare bog lemming, an inhabitant of bogs and fens. I have analyzed the stomach contents of bog lemmings from Montana fens and found that a large proportion of their diet is mosses. Another fen species, the caddisfly, weaves Scorpiotis, a rare aquatic moss, into its larval casing. The rattlebone fen population of caddisflies in northwest Montana harvests sprigs of living Scorpidium and weaves it into a casing that resembles a furry green marshmallow. During the daylight hours, the living sprigs of moss, through photosynthesis, release oxygen, which is trapped in the woven moss casing, causing the larval caddisfly to float to the surface of the pond that is several feet deep. I do not know how the use of a living moss affects the ecology and life history of the caddisflies in Rattlebone Fen. I deposited a specimen of the Scorpidium casing from Rattlebone Fen in the University of Montana Herbarium. The semi-aquatic bird, the dipper, a common resident of Rattlesnake Creek, uses mosses in nest construction and gleans aquatic insects from the dense growths of the mosses Fontinalis scleropodium and Brachythecium that grow on submerged rocks in the stream. The trout in Rattlesnake Creek are also dependent on the aquatic insects that inhabit the underwater moss forest. Red squirrels have collected mosses from my yard and made nests in the nooks and crannies of my woodpile, which has contributed to cleaner air in Missoula. Not wanting to disturb their nests, I have burned very little wood in my fireplace, which has reduced the emission of carbon dioxide and particulates. When identifying mosses with the aid of a microscope, I often am captivated by the tiny critters that skitter across the slide, suspended in a few drops of water. Even after moss specimens have been residing for years in dry herbarium cabinets, upon rehydrating, microscopic animals miraculously appear, especially tardigrades, also known as water bears. A Missoula scientist studying tardigrades found them to be especially abundant in a common Montana moss, Rhytidia delphus triquetris, the electric cattail moss. I am not the only aficionado of mosses in the natural and cultivated landscapes. Mosses are widely used in Japanese gardens among rocks and manicured shrubs and trees. Mosses in Japanese gardens are transplanted from natural sites or are propagated from mosses that have been macerated in a blender with yogurt and spread on the area to be colonized. Apparently, the moss particles regenerate asexually and establish aesthetically pleasing green spaces. I do not know the function of the yogurt, and I have not tried this technique. Another aspect of moss ecology that is often overlooked is that there are no mosses classified as noxious weeds. Noxious weeds cause billions of dollars in lost agricultural production, reduced biodiversity, and cause the introduction of harmful pesticides into the environment. Typically, a noxious weed is a species that is introduced into an alien environment that proliferates largely unchecked by natural controls present in its native habitat. Many mosses have worldwide distributional ranges, and few are narrowly endemic. It is rare that a moss endemic to another part of the country or world becomes established in Montana. There are only a couple of mosses that I know of that have been found in Montana established outside of their typical ranges or habitats as a result of human activities. One example is Calliergonella cuspidata, a wetland species that has become a common component of lawns in the Pacific Northwest and rare member of Missoula lawns. Apparently, a watered lawn approximates the growing conditions of a fen or other natural wetland. Historically, sphagnum moss has been used as a dressing for wounds during wars and as an absorbent in babies' diapers. The prodigious absorption capacity and antibacterial properties of sphagnum render it especially suitable for health and hygiene uses. Unfortunately, sphagnum peat has been extensively used as a soil amendment for gardening, which has caused the destruction of the distinctive and rare vegetation of many fens and bogs across the boreal region of North America. It takes thousands of years to build up a few inches of peat. Eschew peat in gardening. And I do apologize for my mispronunciation of any of the words in that article that I just read to you. I am not trained in Latin. Well, I have a few events that you might be interested in. We're first going to talk about the Wild Montana has an event. You can go to wildmontana.org, click on the Discover tab, and then click Explore Wilderness Walks to find the events being offered around the state. Our local chapter is the Madison-Gallatin chapter, And coming up on July 7th is an old growth forest field training hike. And this is a wilderness walk. So it describes this as Wild Montana is partnering with the Old Growth Forest Network to host a family-friendly hike along the Grotto Falls Trail, where we will learn about how to identify true old-growth forests and what makes them unique. Each participant will have the opportunity to earn an official certificate following this training and dive deeper into the world of the unique and magical old-growth forest networks across Montana. So this is, of course, near Bozeman on Tuesday, July 7th. And if you go to wildmontana.org, as I said, click the Discover tab, and then click Explore Wilderness Walks to find this event, there is a link where you can register, and it follows the hike description. And then Sacagawea Audubon has a habitat restoration and birding tour July 11th from 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. This tour is on rural land east of Bozeman off Jackson Creek Road. Marlena Renwick has used her botanist skills to restore degraded habitat on 40 acres of land by planting over 1,500 native trees, shrubs, and wildflowers. We will take a birding walk as we learn about her restoration work. Expect a 1-mile walk on uneven terrain. We will be gone most of the morning. Carpooling from town is available. To register or get more information, contact either Vicki Saab, and that is all lowercase letters for her email, Victoria Ann Saab, and I'll spell that for you, VicToriaannSaab @gmail.com, or Paulette Eppel, and her email is conservation@sacagaweaaudubon.org, and I will spell that for you, conservation @sacagaweaaudubon.org. And that tour has a 20-person limit, but don't give up, because sometimes people drop out, so if there's an option to put yourself on a wait list, do it. And then Valley of Flowers chapter, Montana Native Plant Society, on Sunday, July 26th at 8 a.m., they are going to be doing a Spanish Peaks Trail. We will take the main trail south from Spanish Peaks Trailhead, following the gentle valley and stopping often to look at the flowers, including side trips to look at montane riparian wetland species along the creek. It's a bit of a drive to a popular trailhead with limited parking, so we will meet at 8 a.m. at the northeast corner of the Bozeman Rosauers parking lot to carpool. Contact trip leader Bryce Peace at 775-550-0759. And if you need more information, you can contact Gretchen Rupp for more details, or to be added to the Valley of Flowers chapter friends email list. And her number is 406-586-8363. Her email, all in lowercase, is beesgrmt@gmail.com. And I know that is a hike that's at the end of July, but it never hurts to get your name in there early. Our background sounds today have come from the Crystal Lake Recreational Area and this is in Montana. Thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to Joe Elliott and Montana Native Plant Society. And thanks to the good people at Bear Gulch Pictographs, preserving history through conservation. Thanks to all the volunteers, supporters, and underwriters that support KGVM. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgvm.org website. Watch those skies, stay well, keep doing good things, and sweet dreams. See you next week.